Hey, everybody. How are you? Good. Did you enjoy your weekend? Yeah. Wanted to say a special word of thanks to all of our veterans. Veterans Day is Tuesday. May we greet them. Appreciate them and the sacrifice they've made, and hope we all continue to pray for our soldiers today, wherever they may be. You know, Mandy and I, my sister married a military policeman, and I've come to appreciate over the last couple years the sacrifice that they make and the toll that it takes on them for the remainder of their lives. So do hope you'll be in prayer and say thank you to a veteran this week. We are in our teaching series on the book of James. Today's a tough one. I'm just giving you a little caveat, man. It's doing a number on me, and perhaps it will on you as well. Let's look at the book of James chapter 3, and we'll read it with some chutzpah this morning. Here we go. Not many of you should presume to be teachers, my brothers, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. We all stumble in many ways. If anyone is never at fault in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to keep his whole body in check. When we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we can turn the whole animal. Or take ships as an example. Although they are so large and are driven by strong winds, they are steered by a very small rudder wherever the pilot wants to go. Likewise, the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. The tongue also is a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole person, sets the whole course of his life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. All kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and creatures of the sea are being tamed and have been tamed by man. But no man can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil, full of deadly poison. With the tongue we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in God's likeness. Out of the same mouth come praise and cursing. My brothers, this should not be. Can both fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring? My brothers, can a fig tree bear olives or a grapevine bear figs? Neither can a salt spring produce fresh water. Oh, boy. You know, not long ago, I was playing golf with our bishop a few months back, and he told me one of his favorite stories about being on the golf course as it relates to language. He and his son, at the time he was the bishop in North Georgia, so Atlanta was the area in which he lived, rather large city, and he and his son, they were out playing golf with two guys they had never met, and it sort of started on the first tee with all of the X-rated, or at least R-plus rated jokes, and there was enough obscenities throughout the front nine to perhaps compete with a Quentin Tarantino film. And so it was quite an adventure and undertaking for him, and as conversations usually go, by the time they got to the 10th tee, they asked him, well, what do you do for a living? And he said, well, I work for the church. Our bishop's a pretty humble guy. You know, he's not the kind of guy who goes, well, I'm the bishop. You know, he just says, well, I work for the church. And they said, really? Well, what church do you work for? And he said, well, I work for the Methodist church. And they said, no kidding. Kidding. We're Methodists too. Which church? And he said, well, actually, I'm your resident bishop. And he said that would be the moment that the round fell apart for those two guys. They could not hit it out of their shadow the rest of the day. And about 2 hours after the round, the bishop got a phone call from these two gentlemen's pastor profusely apologizing for their rather lewd behavior, shall we say. He got a great laugh out of it, and I howled for a good 30 minutes after hearing the story. You know, wherever we're at as a Christian, whether you know, you've been a longtime Christian or you're newer to the faith, maybe you've still got challenges about Christianity altogether, I imagine if you're honest with yourself, there are areas of weakness in your life. And I will just confess to you this morning, openly and upfront, that this is an area that I am always in need of God's grace and God's guidance and more obedience in my life. How do we tame our tongues? Unfortunately, I love two sports that I find myself in 1 minute having praises come out of my mouth, and in the next moment, I can find some of the most vile language come out of my mouth. I love to play golf and hockey. I mean, how can this be? You know, before we really begin to unpack the teaching for today, what we need to do first is say, what is James talking about? What is James not talking about? Because when we unpack this whole bit of language, there's a lot of different directions that it can go. For the most part, what James is going to be talking about in the passage has to do with false teaching. In James's culture, there were a number of people teaching all kinds of doctrines and ideas that were not consistent with who Jesus is, what the church is all about, or the teachings of the church. But also embedded in this passage from James today is some understanding about coarse language. Those would be words that we probably wouldn't want to use around our kids or our mamas, for that matter. Also, we could take that to another level and talk about taking God's name in vain. That's also a possibility, as well as actually cursing other people. Now, we'll save for later the bit on cursing other people and taking God's name in vain. This would be using words like GD or JC in an unholy manner. Perhaps you use those when you drive down the Waterson Expressway and people cut you off and you put your hand on the horn and let a number of words out of your mouth. It could happen when you hit your thumb with a hammer. I don't know. Everybody has certain moments of weakness. But what James does say is this: out of the same mouth come praising and cursing, my brothers and sisters, this should not be. Wham! It's like a 2x4 right between the eyeballs, isn't it? I mean, I must have read that about 50 times, and I thought, Ebel, man, you have a long way to go, brother. Now, perhaps you're already having some manner of cursing dialogue that's happening in your mind right now. Like, why did I get up this morning for this? And why do we have to hear about this today? And maybe you're running a catalog of the things that you even said on the way to church. Good. Now we can really begin to explore James. Why do we curse other people? Why do we take God's name in vain? Why do we use curse words or share false teachings about God? And why do we use the words that we do? What I want you to think about is like a car horn. More often than not, the words that we release from the inside of us are like a car horn. When you use your car horn, what do? You're letting people know that something's bothering you. You're in my way, so there's a soft beep, right? I remember my driving ed videos. There was a guy who was like 60 years old and drove this huge, 1950s convertible. And to let people know that he was coming, he'd said, "Give a friendly tap of the horn." And I thought to myself, if you gave everybody a friendly tap of the horn in today's culture, you probably wouldn't be driving that car very long. But you might give a friendly tap of the horn to somebody who's in your way. Now, if somebody cuts you off and they endanger your life, you might find yourself holding down that horn for about a minute down the highway as you yell a certain number of said choice words. So see, there's always a scalability to what it is that escapes, and the same is true with our mouths. Like a horn, there are certain words in our English vocabulary that are rather cathartic. So when we say them, it releases a certain kind of energy with them. More often than not, hard sounds like K or C give that certain kind of release. It's also well known that certain sound F gives that same kind of release. Are we tracking yet? Yeah. And false teachings about life do the very same thing. A lot of times what people will do is share bits of truth, shall we call them, to help themselves feel better. Well, it's okay, I'm not as bad as her or him. Well, it's okay if I do this because I'm in control, whereas if somebody else did it, they would not be in control. So we self-insulate ourselves from the truth. Now, what's interesting is scientists have done a number of studies about coarse language, and it's usually related, they found, to the amount of hostility that a person has. The more swear words, the more hostile that person is generally in life. And you guessed it, the most hostile word they found is the all-ever-famous F-bomb. Now, They've even done a study. And the study took a number of 19-year-olds and asked the 19-year-old to place their hand in a bowl of freezing cold, icy water. And they found that those who were allowed to swear could keep their hand in the bowl of icy water 40 seconds on average longer than the ones who were not allowed to swear. So there is something about releasing, about engaging, about fighting against the problems that we have. But perhaps we might ask ourselves, is it happening in a productive way? They also said that at the end of the day, the more that you use coarse language or taking God's name in vain or false teachings, cursing other people, the less potent that it becomes. You might recognize this from our culture today. 15 years ago, did you really ever catch many swear words on television? And yet look at it now. Very interesting. Perhaps the bigger issue is who's watching. Take, for example, my little boy and I riding out for an adventure one day. And we get on the highway, and it was an adventure. We got on the highway, and I promise you, I wasn't misbehaving or breaking traffic laws, and I found that there was a guy who was riding my bumper going down the Gene Snyder at about 65, 70 miles an hour for a good mile and a half before we got off the exit ramp. And so we get off the exit ramp, we turn onto a major road, and the guy continues to tailgate me. So I switch lanes, and then he switches lanes and continues to tailgate me. So I switch back to the other lane, and he continues to tailgate me. And by the time we get to the nearest traffic light, he rolls down his window, and he says, "Yeah, that's right. I'm going to tailgate you and kick your behind from here into next week." Now, my internal horn just had to go off at that point in time because this is my kid, right? I don't want anybody to put my kid in danger. So I rolled down my window and I said, "Hey, how about this, you degenerate pack animal with fecal matter for brains? I'm going to kick you into next week." And the moment it came out of my mouth, I realized, I mean, it's funny, but it's not. I realized that the very person I was trying to protect was the very person I was leading astray. I mean, I think the right word would be parent fail. You know, and I tell you this, hashtag parent fail. And I tell you this story, number one, to tell you that you know, I'm very human. I have my own issues, as all of you do. I'm completely imperfect. I'm very much in need of God's grace. But, you know, so often, the very things that we hold so dear and so precious and want to protect and defend at all costs are the very things, people, that we defend at all costs in the wrong way. And I was reminded of this 20 seconds later when my little boy said, "Yeah, Dad, he's a real pack animal with fecal matter for brains." Way to go, Brian. You know, I think we've all cursed someone. I think we've all probably used coarse language. Maybe you've taken God's name in vain. Maybe you've even bent all kinds of teachings about yourself or God or the church around to make yourself sound better. What I really want to drive at today is this simple concept that what comes out of our mouths is a really big deal. Let's take this opportunity. We'll dismiss our kids to Revolution Kids Church. Well, there's much to be transparent about. I appreciate that. Well, let's bring it back to on point. James is first speaking in our passage today to teachers, right? right? He says, those of you who presume to teach will be judged more strictly. One of my favorite seminary professors said the very first day of class, he said, congratulations, boys and girls, you have made yourselves 50% less fit for heaven, because the book of James says that those of you who teach will be judged more strictly. And we all wanted to leave in that moment because we recognize, man, I need a whole lot of God's grace. And so maybe you're saying, great, Brian, I'm not a pastor. I'm not a small group leader. I'm not a Sunday school teacher. This completely exempts me from this teaching today. And to you, I would say, no. No, this very much applies to your life as well, because the reality is, in some way, we're always teaching somebody, right? Whether it's our kids, whether it's the people around us that we work with, our neighbors, whomever, in some way, we're all placed in a teaching role. People ask us for advice. People are watching the way that we live our lives. What we say, what we teach, what we share has both either lethal or life-giving implications. Tyler, in fact, began to share about this last week when he talked about, do we believe in our beliefs more or the God of our beliefs? What we say, what we believe about God, what we believe God is like, truly matters. And how many false teachings and false doctrines and all kinds of lethal ideas about God and the Bible and everything else in between have affected us? I mean, you look at some of the beliefs of our culture today, we have a smorgasbord of different beliefs. Everything from the prosperity gospel, that what God ultimately wants for us is to be rich and happy, to the way that we get to heaven is through our works, that Jesus is just one God among all kinds of other gods who are equally important. And yet these have lethal implications. They affect people's ability to trust God, to serve God, to love God, to pray, to read the Bible, whether or not they go to church. Let me show you a very basic example. If I were to ask you the question, do you believe that God is in control? Most people would say, yes. Let me encourage you this morning that that is the most dangerous thing that you could ever believe. Great, now it got quiet. One of the most dangerous things that you can believe is that God is in control, and here is why. We believe that God is the author of good, yes? We believe that God is loving, yes? We believe that God is holy, yes? Yes. Do you ever see evil or sin or death or suffering in the world? Now, here's the deal. If God is in control, God therefore made those things happen, yes? Which would make God the author of good and evil. Now, I don't know about you, but that's a serious disconnect for me. So let's shape that a little bit this morning. How about we go this way? God is in charge, but God is not always in control. Well, how can you do that, Brian? Here's how we can do that. God is in charge. This is ultimately God's creation. God made it. Yes? God puts us here. God is taking all things towards resurrection, towards restoration, towards the defeat of evil and sin and death. But God is not ultimately always in control, and the reason is simple. People have this thing called free will. And what's free will? Free will is the desire to be God and be in control. And when we're in control and God is not in control, what usually happens? Something not good. Yeah. And so here's the deal, folks. Lots of people who believe or hear that God is in control and are experiencing suffering or death or pain or whatever it is, they associate that God did this to them. God didn't bring that on you. God's in charge. God is not always in control. In fact, part of the problem with the world and the culture that we live in today is that too often God is not in control and people are in control. And when people are in control, it all goes south and sideways in every other direction that you want to talk about. And so if people believe that God is both the author of good and evil, if God brought this horrible thing into their lives, how will they ever be able to trust God? Why would they bother to pray? Why would they want to read the Bible? Isn't it ironic that the time in which we need God most, usually in our suffering, it's usually the moment in which we run from the furthest possible place we can from God. Well, why? Well, because if God did this to me, how could I trust God to bring me out of it? And so when we say that false teachings, certainly they're not a part of our culture or our churches today. Absolutely they are. And in fact, some of the contemporary Christian music that we listen to is filled with this kind of language that God is in control. God is not always in control. God is in charge. And what he's seeking from each one of us is to hand over the control that we have so that we might follow him and become like him. Now, I'm not saying that churches can't, you know, believe different things or that all of our beliefs have to match uniformly, but ask yourself, at the end of the day, are the beliefs that I have about God, is the relationship that I have with God, is it biblical? Is it logical? Does it fit within the traditions of the church for the past 2,000 years? Have I experienced it in my own life? And if you can't answer yes to those questions, then I would ask you to reconsider what it is that you believe. We can't do away with the resurrection of Jesus, for example. We can't say that he just went up to heaven on the third day. There's no point in being here. Let's all go to the bar this morning. You know, you can't say that Jesus is only moderately significant. He's either of immense significance or he's of no significance at all. This is what a C.S. Lewis says. I mean, if God really wanted us to be saved from sin or forgiven from our sin or brought into relationship with him, it sure seems like he went to a lot of trouble on the cross to prove otherwise, don't you think? So we certainly can't say that he's of moderate significance. He's either of immense significance or of no significance. What we believe, what we say, the doctrines and the teachings that we listen to and hear and bring into our hearts from the mouths of other people really matter. And I hope for you in your own life, you know, I'm thankful that you are part of this community here, but I hope that you test what I say. Because you should always be testing what kind of teaching you hear, because it matters. It shapes the way that you relate to God. It shapes the way that you pray or read the Bible or whether or not you go to worship on a Sunday morning, and it matters. And folks, here's the deal. Forming these beliefs isn't just up to the pastor or the staff or Sunday school teachers or small group leaders, but in some way, all of us are teaching. In some way, God is calling all of us to be Christ-like and truthful in our speech. Your conversations that you have every day with people are either going to help draw them toward God or push them from God. So what you say really does matter. What do the scriptures say? It says, speak the truth in love. James says to keep our speech or our tongue in check. Because so often sin starts with the words that come out of our mouth. Let's take something as basic as the Ten Commandments. Shall love the Lord your God and serve him only. How do we first begin to turn from that commandment? By what we say. I mean, how often do we ascribe love to some of the strangest things in the world? Like, I say that I love pizza. Do I really love pizza more than God? I mean, seriously not. But it's a colloquialism that we use all the time now. Or I just love that band. Or I just love, you know, so-and-so who's on the television. I just love golf. I just got one right there, right in the heart. Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Let's take, for example, adultery. Where does adultery usually begin? Speech. Conversation, yes? Honoring your father and mother. Where does that usually begin with? Speech. Murder. Where does that usually begin with? Speech. I hate that person. I want to kill them. Do you mean it literally? Probably not at that moment, but you plant that kind of seed in your heart, and what is it that begins to germinate? All kinds of weeds and vines that begin to choke the life out of you until you make a decision that has life-altering implications, not only for other people, but for you. Look at the example of the lost son. In Luke chapter 15, we hear about a son who goes to his father and says what? Father, give me my share of the inheritance. That's a pretty cheeky thing to do in the ancient world. He could have been stoned for that. So he dishonors his father and his mother, and the place that it begins with is speech, and it leads to greed, it leads to corruption. He grows away from his family, and before he knows it, he ends up in a pig pen. So much starts with speech. You see, what we say, whether we bless people or curse people, whether we use coarse language or godly language, true teaching or false teaching, can lead us and lead others to or away from God. Now, many of you are saying, man, this is way too extreme this morning. I mean, come on, it's November. Lighten up a little bit. Thanksgiving's coming. Maybe. But consider that one man said, for the good of the people, to raise a nation from the ashes, when no one would help, he would be the country's guiding light. That he was there to grant equal rights to all people, and it would be critical to peace and stability and the welfare of the nation. And he even went so far as to say that he wouldn't tolerate those who attack Christianity, because his movement was above all things a Christian movement. You know who said him? Adolf Hitler. Frightening. How much of this kind of rhetoric gets spun around our culture today? And who's putting it in check? And who's challenging and questioning the motives behind it? Maybe amongst your friends, maybe on a larger kind of sphere. Nobody checked, nobody questioned, nobody challenged this kind of false teaching. And look at what happened. From 1933 to 1939, for 6 years, this was the spin. And after 1939 in September, when World War II began, 85 million people died. What we say matters. What we say matters. It leads people toward God, or it leads people away from God. It leads people to becoming like Jesus. It leads people toward becoming like the image of destruction. And James says it best. He says, the tongue is a fire. It can corrupt the whole person, sets the course of life on fire, and the tongue itself is set on fire by hell. Hitler's tongue, there is no doubt, was fully controlled by evil and the power of the devil. And when we find ourselves lying or spreading false teaching, when we find ourselves being critical, overly critical about other people, or using all kinds of coarse speech again and again and again, or taking God's name in vain again and again and again, we'll find ourselves growing further and further from God. It's that simple. You know why? Because the tongue and the heart are linked. Let me invite the band to come on back up. And folks, this is why we have to discern our language. Not just about ourselves, but about the people that we allow to have influence in our lives. Are they bringing you further away from God or closer to God? And not just the filthy stuff, but the silver-tongued stuff that sounds like it's all heart and hearts and flowers. Perhaps that's the most dangerous of all, because your tongue and your heart are linked. The more in tune we are with God, the more in tune our tongues become. And so I think what much of James is saying to us this morning is, be real to God, be real about God, be real for God. Let's continue to reflect on the condition of our hearts and the condition of our tongues this morning. Let's pray. So throughout the teaching series, James has been teaching us that faith and works, they're supposed to fit together. The question for us here is, how do we put faith and works together? Maybe a couple of things that will help you. Number one is to ask yourself this question: who is in charge of your rudder? Right? James says that the tongue is like a rudder. It guides and directs us. Who's in charge of the rudder? Charge. Notice I used that word. Who's in charge of the rudder? Yeah, yourself or God? I mean, you know, realize with every word you say, you become more like Jesus or less like Jesus. You're like, wow, man, that's heavy. But think about it. It starts so small, and then before you know it, you find yourselves miles away. So will you speak life? Will you speak truth? Or will you speak something else? I mean, so much of the negative things that we say in our lives, I want you to realize, are about misplaced anger. Rather than truly confront people in a society that's built on this false doctrine of tolerance, rather than confront people in love, we just stuff it. Right? And so then what happens? Then it's all going to come out at some point. Nobody can stuff it forever. I hope you realize that. It's going to come out. And so then what happens? You get on the expressway, and before you know it, you find yourself yelling at the top of your lungs, or you're with your kid, and you've had a rough day, and the kid behaves in some way, and then what? Right? Mount St. Helens is coming out your ears and your eyeballs and your mouth. Or you're at work, and the person who's like the one nice person in your office, you find yourselves spewing it all at them. Why? Because you haven't confronted the people who've really done you the harm. Confrontation doesn't have to be negative. It doesn't have to be evil. It doesn't have to be overly critical. Some of the most powerful words that you can ever say to another human being when they hurt you is this: "You hurt me. Here's why." And then just let it out. You don't have to say, you know, you're a pack animal or, you know, the things that I did, but just, "You hurt me and here's why." And don't go, "Oh, bless their heart," or "He just doesn't know," or no, "You hurt me. Here's why." Who's in charge of your rudder? God doesn't ever seem to have a problem confronting. Jesus, as much as we try to make him this meek, mild, docile person who never gets angry, I see him having all kinds of confrontations with people all throughout the New Testament, and especially with religious people. You're keeping people away from the temple and away from God. Stop. This is the gist of what Jesus says. And the second thing we might do is learn a new vocabulary. Learn a new vocabulary. So if you've got a favorite go-to word, pick a new one. My kids watch this television show that when the characters get angry, they say, "Oh, coconuts." I've been trying it out. I kind of like it. Because it makes you laugh, doesn't it? I mean, it's silly to hear a grown man, well, some days, 38, yell out, "Oh, coconuts." I mean, what is that all about? But it's really helpful because it reminds me that it's okay to release and to vent. And at the same time, I don't have to do it in a negative, you know, life-altering kind of way. "Oh, coconuts." Try it out this week. You'll love it. Driving down the highway. "Oh, coconuts." It's just good stuff. Anyway, James says in his letter that when the wrong kinds of desires are born in our hearts, it gives birth to sin and then sin to death. And do you know why sin kills? Because it so often reproduces. And do you know where it reproduces first? Right here. So my encouragement is this week, speak words of truth and of life. Jesus says, let your yes be yes and your no be no. Confront the people who bring you harm. And speak truth wherever you go. And in the end, know that God will lead you closer to him and closer to life and closer to the kind of life in which you're able to thrive. Let's pray.